This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK, talking about what Trump is actually doing, not just what he's tweeting. Later in this hour, the LA Times' series of six editorials about Trump, titled Our Dishonest President, was published as a book on July 4th. Nick Goldberg, editor of the paper's editorial pages, will explain. Also, young people are voting for old socialists in many countries. Why is that? We'll ask Sarah Leonard. First up today, Trump's voting commission. Most of the state governments are resisting it, even the red states. It's pretty amazing. John Nichols will comment. Trump Watch starts right now. Well, our number one Trump watcher today is John Nichols. Of course, he's national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He's got a new book coming out next month with the fabulous title, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. We reached him today, as usual, in Madison. John, welcome back.
John Wiener, it's great to be with you.
Well, back on June 28th, the Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who is vice chair of Donald Trump's Presidential Commission on Election Integrity, and we're putting that in quotation marks, election integrity, Kobach sent a letter to all 50 states requesting lots of voter data, including every registered voter's social security number, party affiliation, information about criminal backgrounds, military history. What happened then?
A lot of people said no. And they said no for a lot of different reasons. But it's actually a very good example of how little Donald Trump, Mike Pence, who, by the way, is the official chairman of this bogus committee, and Chris Kobach, Secretary of State of Kansas, longtime voter suppression advocate, how little they really know about America. Because the one thing that brings lefties and progressives and even mainstream Democrats who don't like Donald Trump together, or don't like Donald Trump very much, together with right-wingers who fear black helicopters, surveillance, and the government, is a sense that you don't really want to give your records to somebody who's got no reason to have them. And so we have had this remarkable phenomenon that we are now up to, depending on how you count them, because some states have given a complete no, other states have given a partial no, but we're in the range of, you know, 42 to 44 states that have said no.
Yeah, I think the last count I saw was 45 have said no in one way or another. The other five, that's 45 out of, there's 50 states, so that's 45 out of 50. The other five have not said yes. The other five have not answered yet. And that, that includes Hawaii, Illinois. I doubt that they are going to want to cooperate with the Trump administration. And
well, Hawaii has, you know, it certainly doesn't have what you would call your Republican governance at most levels. And Illinois, well, it has a Republican governor, has a Democratic legislature, and most of its down-ballot state officials are Dems. So, yeah, I think you're starting to get the picture here. But this is the important thing to understand, John, and it's the point, you know, that must not be lost here. Some of the roughest letters, some of the most aggressive responses, some of the loudest no's have come from, I don't know, places like Alabama.
Yeah. Yeah, Mississippi. Here I have the quote from Mississippi's Secretary of State told Trump and Kobach to, quote, go jump in the Gulf of Mexico.
That's rather blunt.
And, I think blunt is good, yes.
You understand that this stuff, these responses are popular to the extent that people know about it, to the extent the story has been told. These stances are popular with the voters. Now, this gets into a complex reality, John, and that is that in the United States, we have never had a universal voting system.
Right.
We have always parceled it out to the state. Now, I've got a lot of problems with that. Because I would like to see us have a baseline in this country that said, you know, like baseline protection for voters and things of that nature. Unfortunately, Kris Kobach and these people, they're not trying to get this information by any reasonable measure in which to establish a good baseline for democracy. The general sense is that if you look at Kobach's record, if you look at Donald Trump's tweets and statements and you know, assessments of his own circumstance, you come to a default position that is, if you give these people this information, they will use it in the most nefarious and destructive of ways as regards democracy. And I don't think that's an unreasonable statement. Serious advocates for voting rights, serious advocates for privacy, serious advocates for, you know, a host of other assessments of what you might do with data, are pretty well united in saying it's a very bad idea to give this information to Kris Kobach.
Well, Trump's idea, the rationale for what you call this bogus Election Integrity Commission, Trump has said we have a problem, which is that 3 to 5 million people voted for Hillary illegally in November, which, of course, explains why she beat him by 3 million votes. The arithmetic comes out very simply. So,
it's ironic.
And the commission is supposed to come up with the evidence proving that there's millions of people voted illegally in the United States. How many people do you think voted illegally on November 8th?
Well, you know, there are people who vote illegally. I want to make that clear to you. States, you know, with some states with Republican attorneys general and very aggressive examiners of these things have discovered examples of it. It is such a tiny handful of people, such a small number, that you can actually assess the cases. And you know what they have found?
What?
They have found sometimes like Republican legislative aides that voted twice. And, you know, they found an occasional guy who voted for his wife the week after she passed away because he was sure of who she wanted to vote for. And, you know what I mean? If you could actually list them, there's such a handful of them nationwide. And, of course, what experts on this will tell you is that our problem in America is not people voting illegally. Our problem is that people have a hard time voting.
Yeah.
That we make it difficult for people to vote. And so far from having a crisis of all sorts of people showing up, you know, secretly voting in illegal or illicit manners, we have very, very low turnout. We have a far lower participation. And where people do make a mistake, or, you know, in the exceptionally rare case where they may vote inappropriately, there's no evidence that this is some sort of concerted effort to help a Donald Trump or to help a Hillary Clinton or anybody else. It's an anomaly, and it's an anomaly that could be dealt with if we made voting easier, not making it harder. And the final thing I'll just say on it, just to keep in mind here, is that you're broadcasting today from California.
Yeah.
And it is important to understand that Donald Trump's theory, false theory, completely false theory, his fantasy that that there's, you know, massive illegal voting in America is largely rooted in California, in his view. And his sense is that he lost the popular vote nationally because of California. And you know, certainly California overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton over him and, you know, poured in a lot of votes to that Hillary Clinton 2.8 million vote victory over Donald Trump in the popular vote. But Trump's response to that has been this completely unwarranted, totally disproven claim that you had this incredible level of illegal voting in California. And here's the weird part about it, John. California, from the start to the finish of the process, was an absolutely certain state for Hillary Clinton. So why would you pour in all kinds of illegal voting there?
Excellent point.
It doesn't work.
Excellent point. Well, as you said, we don't have a national uniform voter registration or voting system. It's the states set their own laws, and then the states delegate to the counties. It's the counties that actually run the polling places that count the votes. In California, there's some news about California that I want to let our listeners know about. California, of course, were especially interested in flipping Republican congressional seats in 2018, next year. Especially, well, here in L.A., we're very interested in Orange County, where Hillary carried Orange County, the first Democrat to do so since FDR in 1936. And there are three Republicans in Congress from Orange County who we think can be defeated. So the vote in Orange County is crucial to the Democrats retaking the House. And the California State Legislature passed something called the Voters' Choice Act last year to make voting easier and encourage more people to participate. Under this California law, counties may, if they choose to, send mail ballots to every registered voter. This is a radical new way of voting in California. Send mail ballots to every registered voter, so everybody can vote by mail if they want to. The counties would set up ballot drop-off stations and consolidate election day polling stations into centralized voting centers that any voter could vote at any polling station. They would be open for 10 days before election day, including weekends, either to fill out a ballot or to drop off your vote-by-mail ballot. Orange County, target of Democratic efforts for 2018, the Orange County Board of Supervisors, five Republicans, rejected this option offered by the state. Orange County is not going to make voting easier, encourage more people to participate, even though it's estimated this system would save them $10 to $20 million per election by having, instead of lots of tiny little polling places, having this bigger early voting and more centralized voting system. So this is yet another of the many examples we have chronicled here of how the Republicans as a party are committed to vote suppression and the Democrats are committed to voter turnout.
Well, I mean, look, Democrats haven't always been on the right side of these issues, right? There's the Democratic Party has a terrible history, in the South especially.
Yes.
And so what we realize is, and the only reason I point that out is that what we realize is that voting and access to voting, the ability to vote, has always been used by political parties who are advantaged or disadvantaged for their own purposes, right? I mean, this is a troublesome reality because unlike most countries around the world, when we subsume control of the process down to that county level, most of those county officials are elected as partisans.
Yeah.
Not as you know, nonpartisan, do good for all humanity, and not experts. They're political players who are there for partisan reasons, and this is where it becomes very, very problematic, because we have irregular, unsteady, and often unreliable voting systems that actually causes partisans on all sides to say, oh well, I better do this or I better do that, you know, to kind of keep ahead, because you never know what the other guys are doing. We really, really do need to revisit this issue and to think about how we can kind of get ourselves out of the trap that we've put ourselves in. But in the short term, the thing that we should be conscious of is that states shouldn't do what California did. States should not create an unsteady or irregular system. Right? Mm. What they should do is create a statewide fix.
Yeah.
Like Oregon has, or like Washington State.
Yeah.
Others have, many states have moved to this. Now, that's not to, you know, I mean, in the specifics of what Orange County has done, it's terrible. It's reprehensible. It should be protested, challenges should go to the courts, etc. But in the longer term, what we ought to do is go for, some, at the very least, the state level, we should have universal rules. And to give you an example of why that's important, I'll just go back to one of our most famous crises in voting processes, and that was State of Florida, 2000, Bush v. Gore.
Oh, yeah.
67 counties. Every county had its own voting system. I can pinpoint for you counties where Al Gore lost the 537 votes he needed to be president. Right? I can point to the voter. I can point to the ballot design. I can show you where the systems fell apart. It's that easy. And so what we know is that when we have irregular and unsteady and unreliable voting systems, it creates political reality. And one of the political realities that people need to understand at this point is because we don't have a universal system that seeks to promote democracy and representative democracy, we have a president of the United States who lost the popular vote by almost 2.9 million votes. We have a U.S. Senate where people voted, if you look at across the country, and even at the state levels, you see, you know, a disproportional level of support in state after state and nationally for the Democrats. California alone pumps in a huge number of additional votes for Democrats for control of the Senate, yet the Senate is Republican-controlled. At the House level, we have gerrymandered U.S. House seats across this country that create realities. And, you know, we desperately, as a country, need to pull the brake. Now, I don't expect Donald Trump to do this. I don't expect Kris Kobach to do that. But I do expect enlightened officials like Jerry Brown and others across this country to literally pull the brake and say, hey, we've got to stop. We've got to stop playing games with our democracy, and we've got to start thinking seriously about how to have high turnout, easy-to-vote elections where the right to vote is supreme and is protected in state after state. And that's got to become a central theme, not just of, you know, you and I talking on the radio. Frankly, I think the Democratic Party ought to rethink and campaign on that. Just campaign on democracy and say, we're not even going to game it for ourselves. We just want to have a full-scale, open, free, and functional democracy because we think that we're willing to take our chances on that. The fact of the matter is the Republican Party, as currently constructed, refuses to embrace that basic premise that we ought to have a high turnout, democracy-sustaining political process.
We only have about 2 minutes left here, and I know you've just published a piece at thenation.com proposing the kind of big picture of what Democrats should do. There's somebody named Congressman Don Beyer from Virginia. I never heard of him. He's introduced something called the Fair Representation Act. In 2 minutes, tell us about this.
You don't even need 2 minutes. It's a simple, it's a fabulous idea, and I'm kind of amazed. I'm only amazed that somebody's actually done it. It's wonderful. What Don Beyer has proposed, with support from Jamie Raskin and others, is a national plan to eliminate gerrymandering. And it simply creates a system in states across this country where people can vote for, they can have multi-member districts, right? And so in a district, maybe you might elect, depending on how this has worked out, but it's essentially a system where your district might have may have five members, let's say. And you can vote for five, or you can vote for three, or you can vote for one, however many. But the end result is that it virtually guarantees that the minority party will have representation, and it eliminates the horrible game of jamming, you know, all the Democratic voters into one district or all the Republican voters into another, and it just opens the process up. I know that even as I describe it, they may sound a little complicated to people who aren't familiar with multi-member districts, who aren't familiar with instant runoff voting and some of these other reforms, but take a look at the article. It's got I put a relatively lengthy description of it, and I can't imagine that anybody who is a fan of democracy wouldn't love this idea. It's a really, really good proposal. And it doesn't have to be the end of the story. There can be different ideas. And even among supporters of reform and getting rid of gerrymandering, there are different ideas. But the bottom line is this, John. It's not hard to create a functional democracy where our Congress reflects the will of the people. And I can tell you one thing right now. If our Congress reflected the will of the people, we wouldn't be having this absurd debate about getting rid of the Affordable Care Act and doing some horrible draconian thing. And frankly, most of what Donald Trump is proposing, right, wouldn't get off the starting line. if we had a representative House of Representatives, a really representative U.S. House, which is what Don Beyer has proposed.
John Nichols, his new book coming out next month has the fabulous title, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. Read him at thenation.com. John Nichols, always great to have you on the show.
It is a total pleasure talking democracy with you, my friend.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK with Trump Watch and TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, Nick Goldberg of the L.A. Times talks about our dishonest president. That's in a minute on KPFK when our program continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Later in this hour, we'll talk about young voters and old socialists. But first, our dishonest president. That's the series of editorials in the L.A. Times that have just been published as a book by Heyday Press on July 4th. To explain, we turn to Nick Goldberg. He's editor of the editorial pages at the LA Times and co-author of a new introduction to the book. Nick Goldberg, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
Well, the LA Times published this series of editorials long before Trump's first 100 days. What kind of a response did you get when these came out?
Well, we got an overwhelming response. We had been writing, of course, about Trump for a long time, from back in the early primaries. We wrote numerous editorials all the way through the election. We wrote our endorsement of Hillary Clinton. We wrote on Election Day, and we'd been very, very critical of Trump all the way through, and we'd used a lot of harsh language, and we'd been unequivocal in saying that, you know, we thought he was unsuited for the job and unfit and unqualified. So when the series came out, I didn't really know what to expect. I didn't know if people would see it as a change in tone or as very dramatically different from what we'd already been writing. But the response was overwhelming. The series, which was a six-part series, went completely viral, went out to millions and millions of people. The first day of the 6 days alone got 4.5 million page views, which is more than we're used to getting for our run-of-the-mill editorials.
And I saw that the total was something like 7 million page views. What is it about these six editorials? You said you have published many before that. What made these six different from the criticisms of Trump that appeared every day, not just in the LA Times, but everywhere in the mainstream press? I think every newspaper in the United States refused to endorse Trump and endorsed Hillary. So what was it about these six that got 7 million page views?
Well, you know, we had been, like everybody else, we'd been writing individual editorials, one-offs here and there, saying, we don't like his position on this, or we don't like this appointment, or we don't like this nomination, or rejecting, or this tweet was irresponsible. And finally, we decided it was time to pull it all together. We wanted to try to connect the dots. We wanted to try to give our uber analysis. And I think that's what resonated with people. We really, not only did we use pretty harsh and uncompromising language, but we really tried to pull together a coherent view of Donald Trump. And the view, our basic argument was, look, we don't like this guy's policies. We think he's wrong on immigration, on climate change, on pollution, on Obamacare, on many, many things. You know, that we would dislike those things in most of, if any of the other Republicans had become president, too. We said the problem that we have with Trump is really about Trump himself. It's not his policies. It's that he's erratic and he's reckless and he's petulant and he's untethered to reality and he's narcissistic and he's profoundly untruthful. And I think it was that analysis that resonated.
Yeah, your argument here is not just that Trump is unprepared and arrogant and ignorant. How many adjectives do we need? Abusive, untrustworthy.
We used our thesauruses.
You go a step farther than describing his character and his personality and his conduct. You say he's a threat to democracy. Now, that's a big difference. That's a big step from saying he's unprepared or he's untruthful. What makes him a threat to democracy?
Well, again, you know, our argument was partly about his character and his personality and why they were unsuited for the job. But we also made the case that he was, in his recklessness and in his disregard for tradition and for the rule of law and for all the things that most of the presidents who came before him, you know, had adhered to, that in his recklessness, he was really creating dangers. And he was doing this by undermining institutions. And we talked about, you know, the ways in which he was undermining the courts and the intelligence community and the electoral process and, of course, the media. And then we talked a lot in the series about his profound disregard for the truth and the lies he tells and the misstatements he makes, and we argue that too is dangerous for democracy because he's diminishing people's respect for actual truth, for science, for documentation, and by muddying fact and fiction, he's confusing people, and he's a danger to the idea of objective reality, really.
Well, let me play devil's advocate here for just a minute and argue the important thing is what Trump has been doing, not his character, his temperament, his tweeting. And what he's been doing is pretty much the standard Republican playbook. Less regulation, lower taxes, restrictions on immigration, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. Don't you think any Republican president would have done that? Repealing and replacing Obamacare? That's hardly Trump's idea. Banning Muslims from immigrating. Well, the courts stopped him from doing that, and he accepted the court rulings. He could have defied the courts. I mean, the courts don't have an army to enforce their rulings, but Trump respected the courts. Isn't that significant?
I don't think Trump respected the courts. Trump did not defy the courts. To defy the courts would have been to have created a constitutional crisis unlike anything we've seen in I don't know, a century. It's hardly reassuring to say that he didn't disregard the rulings of the courts, but in fact he did disrespect the courts. He did criticize judges in terms that most politicians don't use because they understand that even though some rulings go your way and some rulings go against you, the underlying fundamental institutions of this country and of democracy are important. They're what keep things running, and we can't undermine them. I believe that, you know, of course I agree with you, John, that Trump, many of Trump's policies are highly offensive and wrongheaded, and I believe they should be reversed. But I do not believe that we can say, oh, he's just like any other Republican politician, and that if this had been Mitt Romney or Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or John McCain, you know, we would have seen many of these same things, because I do believe that Trump is categorically different, and that when you try to put your finger on what's categorically different, you keep coming back to his character and his personality and his human failings.
So let's talk a little bit about what's in this book and what's online at latimes.com. You divided this into six parts. What are the six parts?
The six parts are, well, we did a big opening overview, then we did a full day on lies and truth. We did a day on the undermining of institutions. We did a day on Trump and his conspiracy theories. We did a day on Trump's war against the media. And then we at the end, we had a sort of sum-up piece that talked about what people can do, what states can do, and specifically what California could or can do to help mitigate the potential damage. And then, you know, like everything we do at the LA Times these days, this was a multimedia extravaganza. You know, the series ran in the print paper, and it ran online, and we did a podcast with it, and we did responses, and we took phone calls, and we did, we did everything we could think of to make people engage with it, which they did. And
yeah, so tell me, I know you set up a special telephone comment line and invited people to call up and tell you what they thought. What did you get on the telephone comment line?
Well, you know, we got thousands and thousands of online comments. We got hundreds and hundreds of letters. And then we realized that our switchboard was also being overrun with phone calls, with people who wanted to comment one way or another about the series. And we decided, well, why don't we set up a special line where we'll let people vent or criticize us or compliment us or add to what we've said. And we taped all the calls, and then we put them together in a podcast where the editors and writers of the series responded. And one of the most satisfying things about this series was that because it went to so many people, it didn't just go to the usual suspects. It didn't just go to, liberal readers in the city of Los Angeles. It went out all over the country, all over the world. It went to red states. It went to blue states. And everyone was responding. And it was really a highly satisfying endeavor in that respect.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with Nick Goldberg. He's the editor of the editorial pages at the LA Times, and we're talking about the precedent-shattering series of six editorials the Times ran called Our Dishonest President, an editorial series which has just been published as a book by Heyday Press on July 4th. So of the thousands of comments that you got, I assume there was some pushback from Republicans. Am I right about that?
Sure. We got really way too many responses for me to focus on all of them. But, we got lots of response from Republicans. We got lots of response from Democrats. We got people who criticized us for being too easy on Trump. We had people who criticized us for being for rushing to judgment and casting our judgment in stone before even the first 100 days were up. We got many, many, many smart and interesting responses, and that was fun.
One of your six entries is called Trump's War on Journalism. Of course, Trump today continued his war on journalism in that press conference before the G20. He complained about CNN and negative in fake news. Do you know if Trump's war on journalism led him to notice the LA Times series, Our Dishonest President? Did you ever hear from Trump about this?
We did not hear directly from Trump. We did not hear about it in a tweet. He didn't call us, failing or dishonest or garbage. We were a little sorry about that because a nice tweet from the president to his, whatever it is, 40, 50 million Twitter followers would have been only good for the series.
So I guess he, he's been blasting away at CNN and MSNBC anchors. I guess he watches TV and maybe doesn't read the newspapers quite as much as he watches TV.
We know he reads the newspapers. I mean, he reads more in New York Times, I think, than LA Times because he's a New Yorker. But we know that this series was read in the White House. We know people were upset by it. We know it was talked about a lot in Washington. I don't think there's really any way that the president didn't see it or wasn't aware of it. I just think we happened to hit at a moment. It was my sense at the time that we hit at a moment when they were successfully keeping him under control. He was not on those particular days in some kind of mad tweet fest of rage at the press. So we didn't get one of his personalized notes.
I want to ask a larger question of what exactly are newspaper editorials in this day and age? Newspaper editorials used to be the voice of the owner, and there were Republican papers and there were Democratic papers. The L.A. Times, I had to look up. Who is it who owns the L.A. Times now? It's a it is Tronc. What is Tronc? And does Tronc tell you what to say about Trump?
No, I mean, you're raising a good question. I mean, the first thing to say is that the editorial pages of a mainstream newspaper like the L.A. Times or the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal, the editorial pages are separate from the news pages. You know, it is the model of the mainstream American newspaper is that that news reporters go out and they try to report stories as objectively as they can. They try to put their biases aside and they report on both sides. They talk to both sides and they try not to give their opinions in what they write, and they allow the readers to draw their own conclusions. But on the editorial pages, we're allowed to have a point of view. This is the one place in the paper where we can be opinionated, we can be biased, and that's what we do. We have an editorial board of 8 or 9 people, and we meet 3 times a week, and we write editorials every day that reflect the opinions of the newspaper. And you're right. In the old days, it was clear who the editorial board spoke for. The editorial board spoke for the owner of the paper, whether it was the Sulzberger family or William Randolph Hearst or the Chandlers here in L.A. or the Grahams in Washington. That's who you were speaking for. But newspapers have, you know, they don't have the same kind of ownership that they used to. And our company has gone from the hands of the Chandler became a private company for a while. Then it was a public company. Then it went into bankruptcy. Then it was owned by a real estate developer. You know, now it's owned by this company, Tronc, which has shareholders. But to answer your question, no, they don't tell us what to write. They stay out of it. It's the editorial board and the editorial page editor, that's me, and the publisher of our paper. And we're all, you know, we meet and we discuss and we try to hash out complicated issues in line with, you know, the precedent that we've created over the years. We're a relatively liberal editorial board. We try to stay consistent and not contradict ourselves, you know, from one day to the next.
And of course, you're located in Los Angeles County, which I believe has more Democratic voters than any place on earth. It's the bluest of the blue. L.A. County is the bluest part of California. California is the bluest state in America. So your local audience, which I guess is no longer the only audience for a daily newspaper, is extremely Democratic.
That's true, but I wouldn't just. As I said, we're a liberal editorial page, but we're not a page of Democrats. We don't see our job as defending the Democratic Party. We don't always endorse Democratic candidates. Sometimes we endorse Republicans. Sometimes we endorse others. We endorsed Arnold Schwarzenegger for governor and Steve Cooley as a Republican district attorney. So we're not in lockstep with the Democratic Party, which we criticize from time to time.
There's one of these chapters that I want to ask you about specifically. One of the 6 editorials that are now collected in this book, Our Dishonest President, is called Why Trump Lies. Why does Trump lie so much?
Well, we had a lot of long, heartfelt discussions about that and how to characterize Trump's relationship to the truth.
Let me just interject here that the New York Times ran a whole page of what they said were Trump's lies every day that he's been in office. Was that the sort of thing you were thinking about doing?
Well, we didn't do a compendium of the lies the way the New York Times did, but we wrote about. I mean, we concluded that the president has a profound disregard for the truth, and it's so profound that he either doesn't know or he doesn't care what's the difference between fact and fiction. You know, some of what he says is clearly lies. That's when he has an intent to deceive. He knows what the truth is, but he says something else. Other times, he seems to merely disregard the truth. But we determined at some point it doesn't really even matter whether he knows what he's doing or not, because altogether he's muddying reality and diminishing respect for truth among people. He's making people confused, and it's a recipe. You know, if people don't know where they can go to agree on the same basic fundamental truths, if everyone goes off to their own part of the internet to read what they believe, and it doesn't have to be proved to them, they just believe it because it's said by their people. And that's what I think Donald Trump is encouraging. That's a recipe for division and polarization. If people can't begin to have a conversation where they can reach any kind of compromise or agreement, if they can't agree on the most fundamental things. And that is one of the grave dangers that Donald Trump poses to democracy, in my opinion.
Just to conclude here, I have my favorite thing that Trump said today. In his press conference, he said, we don't know for sure about Russian hacking of the election. Maybe it was Russia. Maybe it was other countries. We don't really know. But Obama should have stopped the Russians from hacking. Now, you see, there's a problem there. Should Obama have stopped the Russians from doing something that we don't know if it was actually happening? Or what here? So does this count as a lie, or what exactly is it?
Unlike the New York Times in that compendium they did, I try to stay away from the word lie, except in situations where I absolutely know someone is lying. I don't consider a misstatement to be a lie, and it's often hard to know what's a lie. But yeah, Donald Trump flails around. He looks for things that exonerate him. He looks for, you know, ways that he can make his enemies sound bad. And if he contradicts himself from one moment to the next, that doesn't bother him at all. And very often it doesn't seem to bother the people who are listening to him. So he can say, we don't know if it was the Russians who were hacking. And then in the next moment he can say, someone should have punished the Russians for hacking. And, it just all goes out there into the atmosphere. I think it's terribly dangerous, terribly depressing and damaging.
Our Dishonest President. That's the series of six editorials in the LA Times that got more than 7 million page views online. They've now been published as a book by Heyday Press on July 4th. You can download it. You can buy the paperback. Nick Goldberg is the editor of the LA Times editorial pages and co-author of the introduction to the new book. Nick, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, John. Nice to talk to you.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK, and this is Trump Watch. Next up, young people are voting for old socialists. Why is that? Some answers in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at trumpwatchpodcast.com. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, this is happening. Jerry Quickly. But first, it's happening all over. Young people are voting for old socialists. Why is that? For some answers, we turn to our young people correspondent, Sarah Leonard. She's a senior editor at The Nation. She also writes for The New York Times and Dissent. Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, I know young people here in the United States were excited about Bernie Sanders, who is a socialist and also an old person. What were the numbers here about Bernie and young voters?
Well, Bernie overwhelmingly won voters under 35. And in fact, he won more of those voters than Trump and Clinton combined. He won completely overwhelmingly with white voters and just over half of young voters of color. So there was a difference there, but very different from his total failure with older voters of color. So it's an interesting set of statistics, but basically he overwhelmingly won young people.
And you have suggested that this is not a case of American exceptionalism. Young people recently have been voting for people like Bernie in some other places.
I think many of your listeners may have been following the British elections, in which Jeremy Corbyn increased Labour's vote share when it was expected to decline under someone as far left as him. And he also overwhelmingly won young people. And not just that, they were really his foot soldiers on the trail. In France, we saw strong youth support for Mélenchon. And in even countries like Greece and Spain, we've seen youth support for quite left parties. In those cases, with younger faces, but Syriza and Podemos.
And Corbyn, let me just emphasize, was a much bigger phenomenon, much bigger among young people than Bernie was in this country. Because, of course, Corbyn was the nominee of the National Party, the leader of the National Party. We have young Republicans, at least I've heard we have young Republicans, but really there are virtually no young Tories in Britain. Have I got that right?
That's absolutely right. What's really remarkable is we saw the leadership of Corbyn increase registrations with the Labour Party overall. So the Labour Party has grown under him, and a lot of that is young people registering with the party to vote because they actually see a candidate who offers them a real choice. They're really excited about him. And whereas before, belonging to the Labour Party might have been sort of an obligation, now it feels very exciting.
How are you defining young? When I was young, Jerry Rubin said, don't trust anyone over 30. Under Jerry Rubin's rule, would young people trust, for example, you?
So I'm 29. I'm just on the verge of being totally 30 and also no longer your youth correspondent. Of course, I'm running a risk here, but... So sometimes sort of young people, often in polls, it's kind of under 35. And I was mostly talking about under 35s, depending on how you count. Many of those people are millennials, of course. And in the U.S. right now, the biggest demographic block right now is millennials. So I'm mostly talking about this generation that has been portrayed often in the media as being sort of apathetic, lazy, we live in our parents' basements, we're all about ourselves. I'm sure you've heard this.
Yes, I have.
In a sense, this gets said about every generation, of course. But in this case, something that I think we're seeing reflected in these elections is that young people, for example, are not sleeping on their parents' couches or in their basements because they're lazy. They're doing it because the job market sucks. And so when millennials are offered some sort of real alternative, it seems like to offer a solution to austerity, a crap job market, downward mobility in general, people actually get really excited and do the things they're always told to do, like go vote.
You know, there's another view that young people are inherently radical and that they move to the right as they get old. Do you think that's what we're seeing now?
I actually don't. There's a fair bit of data that people's political preferences are actually formed while they're young. So late teenager, early 20s are very important formative years for your political perspective. And I think it's fair to say that millennials are experiencing a different period of political formation than, say, Gen X. And in the case of millennials, we're seeing that people came to political consciousness after 89, right? So no one's thinking about the big communist threat, right? Or the socialist threat. But people came to political consciousness more around the time of the recession in 2008. So people have a very vivid sense of Wall Street and capitalism as sort of big, scary forces that are keeping them from getting jobs, homes, starting families, etc. So I think that's actually sort of the crucible that is forming the political consciousness of this generation. And of course, it will change somewhat over time. But I think that's actually the generational mentality.
The other issue that has been emphasized by socialist candidates, both Bernie in the United States and Corbyn in Britain, is a free college.
Yeah, well, America currently has $1 trillion of student debt. That's not nothing. Britain doesn't compare to us on that front.
Right.
They have increased tuition in recent years, and so they're starting to see lots of college students in debt or young people who are afraid they can't afford college, which for them is a real shock. For us, it's just a worsening situation. You know, there's a real contradiction, I think, for a lot of young people in that you are told to go to college, that that's the right thing to do, and that that's the way you'll get a job. And that is a fact. In America, certainly, you are far less likely to be employed if you do not have a college degree. And so you go and you do that thing you're supposed to do, and then you're suddenly in absolutely insurmountable amounts of debt. And so it's really reasonable from an economic perspective that young people would want free college. That's actually sort of delivering the promise that is held out to young people by everyone from parents to guidance counselors to the marketing of colleges themselves. So I think that was absolutely formative in the UK around Corbyn. You saw a lot of young people going to the polls talking about free tuition. One thing that I think is sort of funny is I saw some analysis after the election that sort of described Corbyn as bribing young people with free college. And so there's this funny contradiction where if we show up and vote on our material interests, we're somehow being bribed. But when we don't, we're told we're just practicing identity politics or something like that. And so what I think we're seeing is actually a relatively healthy and straightforward political consciousness on the part of young people that's still being looked at by a lot of commentators as if it's odd.
You know, we have two phenomena about youth voting in the United States. One is the enthusiasm for Bernie. The other is low turnout. The young people historically in the United States for decades have had the lowest rate of turnout of all age groups, and old people have the highest rate. Do you have any ideas about why this might be?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons. One small reason I'll just mention is that, of course, many states have made it hard for college students to vote, actually.
Yeah.
So if you want to register where you go to college versus where your parents live, voting law has actually intentionally made that difficult because young people do tend to vote left of center. Further, on a sort of meta level, I would say there's been some fantastic research. I mean, famously, this big Princeton study that came out a few years ago that show that ordinary people's preferences, ordinary voters' preferences, and the preferences of their institutions, so things like labor unions, have a negligible effect on policy outcomes compared to the policy preferences of wealthy people and their institutions, like lobbyists, corporations. So I don't think that people are stupid, and I think people can tell when their voices are really being heard and when they're not. And so voting has become a pretty uninspiring thing to participate in. There's not that much of a choice at the ballot box, not to say that Democrats and Republicans are the same, but what we saw with Sanders was people want much more of a choice. And also that once you have elected people, your capacity to direct what those people do to get the things that you want are pretty limited. And so I think we really have a democratic crisis in the U.S., which has been driven by the increase in inequality, which creates this big divide between wealthy people and their institutions and the rest of us in terms of exerting political influence. So that's a long way of saying I think the big choices offered by the recent elections have actually inspired people to get more involved in the political process. And it shows that actually young people are quite willing to be politically engaged when there's something real to engage with.
And let me just emphasize the difference between the Republican states and counties on encouraging youth voting or discouraging youth voting and what happens in the blue states. We record our show in California. California, the state organizes voter registration on college campuses and the counties set up polling places, often in the dorms, always on campus. In the red states and in the Republican counties, it's the exact opposite. They make it hard for students to register, and they move the polling places away from the campuses, so it's hard to get there. It's a deliberate strategy of the Republicans, part of their general approach to politics. I think we call it vote suppression.
Yeah, and I would add that for young people of color, this is even worse because they're both targeted by the sorts of policies you're describing and targeted by policies that are designed to keep Black people from voting. And we saw that in North Carolina most dramatically in the last election. But young people of color face incredible obstacles just in voting. And yeah. So you'll hear people talk about how there is not enough polling in those demographics, how the number of voters is small, hard to collect data. Well, there's a reason for that, and you know, it's intentional.
Last question. I understand why the people voting socialist now are young, but why are the socialists they are voting for so old? Bernie is, I guess, 75. Jeremy Corbyn in Britain is 68. Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France is 65. You know, Bernie's socialism is pre-60s. Is there anybody of the younger generation who can pick up the banner of socialism?
Yeah, it's funny. We are seeing these older candidates who are coming out of an era when the left parties in different countries had a stronger commitment to labor and had a stronger commitment to redistribution, even to socialism in the case of the Labor Party, though not in the case of the Democratic Party. And these are folks who really just held on to their politics as their parties changed around them, as you saw sort of Blairite Labor Party and so forth. And then that baton is sort of being picked up by young people who are experiencing the failure of that interim neoliberal period. Something that I think will be really challenging is that these older candidates, you know, badly need to be succeeded by a next generation. And there's kind of a missing generation of radicals in the middle. So young people have to pick up that baton pretty fast. And I think they are. You're seeing the growth of organizations like DSA. You're seeing great candidates like Pramila Jayapal. But there's a lot of work to do very fast. And I think that's going to be a big challenge.
Sarah Leonard, she wrote about young voters and old socialists for the New York Times op-ed page. Read more of her work at thenation.com. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch. I want to thank my other guest, John Nichols of The Nation. He talked about voting. And Nick Goldberg of the LA Times. He talked about the new collection of editorials titled Our Dishonest President, published by Heyday Press July 4th as a book. You can download it. You can get the paperback. Thanks to our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. Thanks to our producer, Renee Reynolds. And thanks, as always, to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Coming up tonight at 4 on KPFK, This Is Happening. Jerry Quickly talks about more Trump financial shenanigans. Hey, Trump watchers, if you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Trump Watch returns next week at the same time on the same station. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.